Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, July 22nd. On our show, we do our best to address police brutality and other kinds of systemic racism, whether in school or work or applying for bank loans, everything, and how BIPOC communities are the hardest hit by the coronavirus outbreak. Today, wait, what did he just say? Did he say BIPOC? Today, we want to talk about that word, BIPOC. Many of you have heard it. I think many of you still have not heard it, but it's becoming preferred by many people to refer to the people who the acronym stands for. For those of you who haven't heard that acronym before, BIPOC, which is B-I-P-O-C, stands for Black Indigenous People of Color. The acronym is being popularized by some social media users intending to recognize the struggles faced by Black and Indigenous people in America. It singles out Black and Indigenous because of the special histories of slavery and the Native American genocide in this country. But at the same time, BIPOC has been criticized by some for being used as a blanket term to group various peoples together, erasing their individuality, as some critics see it. So we'll explain BIPOC now and its pros and cons, and we want to hear from you. Are you embracing the acronym BIPOC to refer to yourself or to refer to people it covers in general? Make your voice heard on this, on the term BIPOC, at 646-435-7280. 646-435-7280. Have you started to use BIPOC to refer to yourself or others? 646-435-7280. And joining us with some expertise on this and to help answer your questions is Jonathan Rosa, a sociocultural and linguistic anthropologist at Stanford University. Professor Rosa, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Professor Rosa, do we know who came up with the term BIPOC and when it originated?
It's not a term where there's a completely sort of accurate history or an analysis of that history that's been conducted, but it seems as though over the last 10 years or so, various kinds of, I think, progressive racial justice organizations and activists have promoted the use of the term. And so I think the early usages of it were in social media platforms around 2012, 2013, and in relation to recent racial justice efforts, we've seen a more widespread usage of the acronym.
How do you explain kind of the motive behind adopting this particular acronym? What's it supposed to indicate? And how is it supposed to be better than any term that was used before to refer to the same people?
Sure. Well, I think there's a longstanding history of using phrases like people of color to invoke a broader racial dynamic in which white supremacy has anchored power in across various contexts. And so that distinction between whiteness and non-whiteness ends up being important for people in a range of situations. And so people of color is a reference point for that kind of dynamic. I think as various organizations and populations have tried to make sense of the utility of that kind of a distinction or that kind of a category or moniker like POC or people of color, part of the struggle has been around the way that it homogenizes various people's experiences and sort of positions them as though they were the same as one another. And so I think for some people, BIPOC or BIPOC has been a strategy for pushing back against that kind of homogenization. And so that's what's interesting in terms of some people then saying BIPOC is homogenizing. I think the whole point of BIPOC from some perspectives is that it was responding to a previous homogenization. And there's something actually really interesting in that dynamic, which is to say none of these acronyms will ever solve the problem of racial justice by themselves. And so they're more a reflection of where we are in a given moment and how it is that people are making sense of those struggles. And so BIPOC is a tool, or any of these acronyms are tools for engaging in broader struggles. They're not solutions by themselves.
Let's take a phone call. Jennifer in Woodside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks so much for calling in.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really like the term. I recently learned about it just on social media. I wasn't sure what it was. And then when I looked it up, I liked it. I embraced it. I'm a person of color. But when I used to write years ago, I was always torn. I didn't know how to address different populations. I would say minorities, people of third world origin, or, you know, people of color. Like, I was just always trying to identify a group of people, but I wasn't trying to homogenize. I was just trying to just identify in a quick, like, broad sweep. And I've recently, I have a new blog, and I just did my first, like, post using BIPOC, and I found it really refreshing, because I felt like it kind of encompassed the populations that I was trying to address in with one, you know, easy term. But I don't think it homogenizes. I think it's a great, very useful term.
What would you say to this listener who posted on Twitter, and Professor Rosa, I'll ask you the same question. Twitter user writes, why isn't it BILPOC or BLIPOC adding an L? Where are the Latinx folks? Why is it just black, indigenous, people of color, singling out black and indigenous, but not Latinx as another major people of color group in this country? Have you thought about that for yourself, Jennifer?
I mean, I'm of Latino, Latinx origin. My mom's from Puerto Rico. I'm married to an Ecuadorian man.
Uh-huh.
I don't feel like it erases us, because I do agree. I think that in the introduction, you mentioned that black and indigenous, it connects to their specific connection to the founding of this nation. And I'm not erasing Latinos. I'm just saying that I think it makes more, you know, it would, I mean, I wouldn't say don't include the L, but I don't feel like there's an erasure by including them mm-hmm. with POC.
Right. You're not experiencing it that way. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Please call us again. And Professor Rosa, do you want to take on that particular critique?
Sure. Let me just say a few things. I think one of the points that comes up in Jennifer's comments that's really important is that this is a U.S.-based kind of acronym and project of BIPOC. So I think it ties to this nation's particular history and the ways that enslavement and genocide were central to the founding of the nation, and the ways that the legacy, or we live in the afterlife of those systems. Now, in the UK context, you have acronyms like BAME, which is Black, Asian, Minority Ethnic, which speak to the particularity of the UK context. And many people have pushed back against that kind of an acronym there. And so part of what's tricky about all of this is that in some ways, your efforts to address or to articulate racial justice can in some ways get wrapped up with a nationalist project of identifying or defining race and ethnicity. And so this is one of the things we would want to be wary of. Now, that brings the Latinx conversation, or that brings the Latinx issue into this conversation, where we're seeing a reckoning, I think, in this moment from a lot of progressive and radical political perspectives, where people are pushing back to say, wait a second, how is it that this category of Latino, or what has been renamed in a sort of gender non-binary way as Latinx, in what ways has this category been depoliticized and been positioned in ways that make it racially, make it function as though it were a racial category, but such that it ends up obscuring all of the racial diversity among Latinx people? So in particular, the erasure of indigeneity and Blackness in Latin America. So the notion that BIPOC doesn't already speak to Latinx experiences, I think suggests that we are ignorant of the ways that Latinidad or Latinx populations are linked to these histories of African enslavement and indigenous genocide as well. And the idea that Latinx people are outside of those categories from some viewpoints signals how Latinos have been positioned as aspirationally white. And so I think leaving the L out from some viewpoints is a way of saying that, you know, Latinx communities have to sort of reckon with a racial positioning. And so I think POC, it's almost as though Latinx has been located within POC as people try to figure out where it fits into the in relation to blackness and indigeneity.
Let's take another call. Jennifer in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
I think the term, I'm a black person and I really struggle with this term because, we have to be specific about what we're talking about, right? So a lot of times when you hear it, it's almost like we use it because it's easier, it's more comfortable, it's a shorthand, but it also doesn't get specific, right? So even if you say, like, we're talking about police violence against BIPOC people, like, no, we're actually talking about police violence against black people and in some communities, indigenous people, and in some parts of the country, against Latinx people. So let's say that's what we're talking about, right? I think that the terms are it's almost like we so struggle with how to be specific and how to be truthful about what we're talking about, because it's a difficult conversation to have. And so these acronyms, you know, it's the same thing with POC, like it's completely meaningless to me now. Like, what does that even mean? You know, because we're comparing apples and oranges a lot of times when we're trying to challenge these systems. You know, if you're talking about, you know, the fact that black women make 68 cents on the dollar, and you say, well, like BIPOC women don't make as much as white men. Well, there's there's such a huge range. An Asian man is also a BIPOC person, like an Asian woman who makes more than black women. Like, we have to be really specific when we're talking about these issues. And I'm concerned that the term just allows us to kind of put a little bit of perfume on things that are very, very difficult and challenging to talk about.
Jennifer, thank you so much. And Professor Rosa, I guess at very least, it shouldn't be used, as Jennifer is making this point, in such a blanket way that you can't disaggregate from the term when you're looking at, with the examples that she used, black women making less in the workplace than white women, but Asian American women making maybe more, which is, which they would be under the blanket BIPOC label.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. And again, it underscores the way in which any of these labels in a given moment might be politically useful or productive from some vantage points, but might be erasing or marginalizing someone else's experience from another perspective. And so this is what we're grappling with, how it is that a certain moniker or a certain acronym allows us to specify particular realities or particular relationships while also obscuring other realities. Because even if we talk about the ways that black women, so if we think from an intersectional perspective that looks at how systems of power and oppression, how they co-articulate, we could say, okay, how are race and gender co-articulating? And you mentioned Asian women and black women. Well, what if we disaggregate Asianness? Where do Filipino women fit into this in relation to East Asian women? You know, and we would want to think about ways that we might want to, or it might be productive to disaggregate any of these categories. Well, what happens when gender is located within BIPOC or centered within BIPOC? And I think that's part of the question. Always, whose experiences are being centered and who's being erased, and what does this allow us to understand, or what does it prevent us from making sense of?
Right. And that hypothetical I was just stating, I don't mean to suggest that Asian women make more than white women in the workplace. I don't actually think that's true. But as a hypothetical, you know, when we're talking about disaggregating. Now, the other way to look at it is that these are all ways of saying non-white, because whites are just so uniquely privileged in this country, right?
Absolutely. And I think it speaks to an effort towards cultivating racial solidarity among populations positioned as non-white. But these are part of longstanding efforts to cultivate similar forms of solidarity. And we saw this in the post-civil rights era in the United States, where you had various kind of organizations, radical, often political organizations, radical black organizations, Latinx organizations, Asian American organizations, and indigenous organizations articulating their political platforms in concert. We also had a history of the emergence of an intersectional politics where, you know, Black feminist perspectives in the wake of a Black power movement or alongside a Black power movement were saying, wait a second, it's not enough to just articulate or advocate Black power. And we were seeing this in the 70s with, you know, situations like the Combahee River Collective Statement, which articulates a Black feminist viewpoint that says, wait, it's not enough for Black power. We have to think about the unique experience of Black women. So the conversation that we're having today is part of a long-standing history that I think is attempting to address or attempting to conceptualize and enact solidarity while also thinking about the specificity of populations' experiences. Mm-hmm. And that tension between solidarity and specificity is what's at mm-hmm. stake here. So what political struggles can we engage in, and how does BIPOC contribute to that? And part of where I would leave with this in some ways is to say, well, does BIPOC for us help to understand? We've heard these conversations about abolition and decolonization. And I think part of the problem is that we've tended to think that slavery and that indigenous genocide were part of the past. And I think for many people, BIPOC is a way of saying, wait a second, we live in the afterlife of slavery. We live in the afterlife of genocide. And so these are ongoing histories. They're not just in, you know, 300 years ago. They are today. And we can right. see their legacy across a whole range of institutional dynamics. So BIPOC is an attempt to sort of, I think, stake a claim to the ongoing legacy of those systems.
TK in Middletown, you're on WNYC. Hi, TK. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for having this. I appreciate you so much. I just wanted to say I agree with this gentleman so much. I myself, upon hearing the acronym, was like, it's perfect. Because they always lump in, you know, if you have melanin, you're all lumped in together. And Black Americans are not like Jamaicans. They're not like Trinidadians. They're not like Dominicans. They are not like anyone else because they did not have that experience. Everybody else came over here looking for something, wanting something, hoping for something. We did not.
But wouldn't the word Black refer to both the descendants of slaves in this country and people who came to this country from Jamaica, you cite that example, or other Caribbean countries, or from Africa as voluntary immigrants much more recently? Black refers to all of those as a group, or does it not, as you hear it, TK?
As, you know, in the acronym, I hear it as Black Americans because of the way it's put with indigenous. But standing on its own, the way I have heard America used the term, then it's everyone with melanin. And that's also part of an issue with the reparations. And I believe that's why it was done that way, mm-hmm. just to conflate the issues, to make it more confusing, because there is a grand difference between somebody willingly coming and somebody that didn't want to be here to begin with.
I understand, and I'm going to leave it there for that. But Professor Rosa, again, a lot of the people with melanin, as he puts it, who come to the U.S. from anywhere in this hemisphere, their ancestors were brought here in enslavement.
You know, I think this is a really important point of tension and of debate for many populations, and we've seen also in recent years the articulation of another acronym, ADOS, so American Descendants of Slaves, and the question around conversations about reparations. But we'd want to be really careful about sort of saying, how do we hold the U.S. to account for the violences that have been acted upon or that it has visited upon particular populations? So if we're talking about African Americans' experiences in relation to a whole range of Black diasporic populations, we'd want to say, okay, what's the unique kind of experience of different populations, and you know, what modes of redress are appropriate or are productive in terms of thinking about those experiences of violence yes. and marginalization. But part of what's really challenging with this is that we can, again, often fall back on a form of nationalism where we suggest that, wait a second, it's the U.S.-based sort of definition of Blackness that mm-hmm. should be the reference point for Blackness globally, or that will address injustice or anti-Black racism by simply transforming the experiences of Black Americans. And so I think this tension between how to hold particular nation states accountable for the forms of violence they produce, while also trying to address global forms and imperial colonial forms of violence that aren't just restricted to a given nation state. That tension is really important for us to sit with. And it doesn't resolve in any straightforward way, but it's a productive debate.
And we're just about out of time in the segment, but you mentioned that alternative acronym, ADOS, for American Descendants of Slavery, or is it African Descendants of Slavery? Which was it, American Descendants of Slavery? And we have
Descendants of Slavery.
Yeah, yeah, and we have a caller who's calling to refer to that acronym, which maybe she prefers. Jackie in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call. And I don't know if I heard it wrong, but I think the gentleman said that ADOS referred to American Descendants of Slaves, and that's incorrect. It's American Descendants of Slavery. And I am a ADOS woman. I am in my 60s. My parents, my grandparents, my great parents going back were here in this country. We didn't come here, as the other brother and Jennifer referred to. We didn't immigrate here. And I think too many of these acronyms sort of erase our plight in this country. And that's why I wouldn't subscribe to BIPOC.
And the distinction between American Descendants of Slaves and slavery is so we don't say that being slaves was the identity of those people, right? As opposed to human beings in a condition of enslavement?
Absolutely. Exactly what I'm saying.
Jackie, thank you so much. Professor Rosa, we're out of time, but it's been a very, very interesting conversation for people who obviously are engaged in what kinds of language and what kinds of acronyms to refer to different kinds of people are best for the struggle for equality, as I think you accurately framed the context. And we've heard from callers with various points of view on that. And I think for a lot of people who weren't familiar with this conversation, they know now more about why they're starting to hear the term, the acronym, BIPOC. So Professor Jonathan D. Rosa, sociocultural and linguistic anthropologist at Stanford, thank you so much for your time and your expertise.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.